There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Hello and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast that brings together the very best bits of today's show from Tuesday, January the 21st.
We're talking salaries.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
We have this morning two salaries surveys, two skill guides, and one government public sector announcement in the ways of who is getting what for the work they do and how they feel about it.
Where do you want to start?
Let's start with, let's start with the Robert Half survey this morning, which the bit that is most interesting to me here is what employers are looking for. They've got the top 10 jobs that will be in demand for the first half of 2020. And they fall basically into three big categories. One is financial. For example, the top job is actually a management accountant. The second top job in terms of demand is chief financial officers. And the guys at Robert Half say that there is a talent deficit in this area. Another is risk and the laws associated with it. So security analysts, risk managers, all sorts of legal talent needed as well. Legal talent, by the way, particularly around financial regulations and fintech. So a bit of a crossover there. And also with, unsurprisingly, tech, digital transformation, AI, and again, fintech being another big sector. So there's quite a Venn diagram where you can see, for the UAE at least, the areas where the new opportunities and, quite frankly, the big bucks are.
I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile, Brandy Scott, and my LinkedIn profile, the future's not bright.
No, we are fitting absolutely zero of those top 10 job categories this morning. We also have a big survey out from the guys at Michael Page. They have been looking again at where the demand is, unsurprisingly, IT talent, a lot of digitalisation, and a lot of finance and regulation specialisation. But they've also been looking at whether people are actually moving around and what would be causing them to do so. And we've had, I would say, a period of stagnation, a period of, well, you're lucky to be in a job. Is that changing?
We've been speaking to John Eade, who's the regional boss of Michael Page, the recruitment firm behind this survey. And we asked him, are people really confident enough to move jobs, to go to their boss and say, take this job and stuff it?
Candidates are a lot more reluctant to move unless they're very certain. They have to be very sure that it's the right company, it's the right time. And obviously, candidates' confidence in moving creates more opportunity. So we do see that candidates are a lot more cautious in the last couple of years versus, say, 2013 through to 2015, because they know that their move needs to be a secure move that's hopefully going to last in the next 5 years.
And we looked at the reasons, or at least Michael Page looked at the reasons why people might move. Money, obviously, is always one. But people only moving if there is a big chunk of change on the table, not for just a small increase. The other reason, the other big reason that people were looking to move was professional growth opportunities, whether that's a promotion or whether that is training. And we asked that to John this morning as well. To what extent at the moment, a time when we know budgets have been tight, are employers really offering employees incentives such as the opportunity to increase their knowledge and talents?
It's improved a great amount in the last few years with the sophistication of HR improving in Dubai, but also in the wider region. So companies are having to really readjust how they sell their proposition to candidates. And we always advise them of this, because candidates say that to us. You know, when we interview candidates, it's one of the first things they normally talk to us about. When we approach and headhunt candidates, it's not just money that we approach them with. We approach them with the broader, more holistic opportunity within organizations.
Well, we've had a Twitter poll running today, and we're asking very simply, what would it take for you to switch jobs in 2020? And the results are surprising, because I thought pay rise would come out firmly on top. And to be fair, for the first hour or two, it did. But now it's really evenly balanced. Okay, so the three options were pay rise, interesting work, or just happy to have a job. And about one in five people say, look, I'm just happy to have a job. I'm staying put. Fine. But four out of five are talking about what it would take to make the move. 42% say pay rise. 40% say interesting work. So basically a rounding error between them. It's neck and neck between those two things.
And if you can have both, well, then you're winning. We're talking about training, though. I mean, one of the old adages of working in the Gulf is that people aren't necessarily keen to train you. I can remember doing interviews around salary surveys 15, 20 years ago, in which companies would talk about and employees would talk about sort of the feeling that if you trained someone after you'd pay for them to come out here, pay for their kids to come out here, what have you, then they were just going to become more desirable, more expensive, and someone else down the road would benefit from the money that you had put in.
So we asked John from Michael Page if that attitude still prevails.
Not so much. I think businesses realise now that they have to really, truly invest in their employees for the long term. And businesses that adapted to this quite early, it's really paying off for them in terms of their staff retention.
When you've moved jobs, though, in the past, Rich, have you moved for more money on the table? Have you moved for better opportunities? Or have you moved because you're just done with what you're doing? Have you been running to or running away?
Mostly, I think, running to. I'm trying to think. Last job I took was this one. That was just a great opportunity because it's a cool job. The job before that was Bloomberg in London. Money wasn't amazing going back to pay tax, but it was a great opportunity.
Cold, wet, yeah,
exactly.
Dark.
It was great. I enjoyed it. But no, it certainly wasn't a money thing. Before that, I guess, yeah, it was, again, this radio gig and working for Reuters here. Just great opportunities to work with cool people doing something really cool in the media industry. So if I think back the past 20 years or so, it was probably that. What about you?
I'm 50-50. I've definitely moved towards opportunities. And there have definitely been cases, particularly earlier on, when I have been thoroughly miserable somewhere and it hasn't been a good fit. And I've walked from it. Although I'm the sort of person who always walks about 2 years after I should.
Yeah, that's a shame.
But it is 50-50. And I don't think there's any, I mean, we talk about running away from something. I don't think there's any shame, actually, if you're in a job and you just think, do you know what, this doesn't work for me. I'm not, personality-wise, the work isn't a good fit, which has been the case with me before, or, you know, lifestyle-wise, this isn't working for me. I'm not seeing my family, whatever it happens to be. Moving to something that makes you happier, it's not a failure, is it?
Perish the thought. It's quite the opposite. Life's too short not to. Amma has been in touch, says that for him, it's all about learning something new. Really, that's the only thing that could tempt him to make the change.
For me, to be honest with you, I would like to find a talent, something that would help me develop my skills in the future. At the age of 37, money is important, but shaping your personality, your professionalism is more important than the money and bonuses that comes with the career.
Thanks, Amma. A couple of people actually have been in touch today with the same famous quote about HR. And it's this. So, Franz, thank you very much indeed, and Alberto earlier. HR manager, what if we train people and they leave? Chief executive, what if we don't and they stay?
It's very true, isn't it? And I mean, Amma there has got absolutely the right idea when he says, you know, it's not just about the money, it's about the training, because what he's talking about is money on the bank, isn't he? Because effectively, it becomes the same thing. If you become better at your job, or if you acquire additional skills, then you become more valuable, and eventually you get the money anyway.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
We have a slightly contrarian take on the real estate industry this morning. New research has come out suggesting that slowing demand in real estate in the Gulf is not necessarily just a story of oversupply. We are very pleased to be joined now in the studio by Dr. Christopher Payne, chief economist of the company behind that research, Peninsula Real Estate. It's lovely to see you again, Christopher. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me in.
So we've got real estate prices down roughly 30% over the past 5 years in the Gulf.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And you guys are saying that it's not just a question of too many villas and too many apartments. Talk me through your thinking.
Okay, well, when a market is weak, it's obviously because there's either insufficient demand or excess supply. And actually, they're two sides of the same coin. But what we're saying is that is the reason we've ended up in this situation is because it's really been demand has been getting is weak and been getting weaker. We know there's been supply addition. We know there's been a lot of building that a lot of developers have been talking about and discussing in the media. But the real problem here has been weakening demand over the last few years.
So the problem is the willingness to buy in regardless of how much stock is out there.
Well, exactly the point. Now, I just want a quick bit on economics here. So if you think about it, and if you like something and the price goes down, you buy more of it. Okay, so what you'd see is a price fall and an increase in the quantity of transactions. What we've seen, Dubai Land Department data shows us, is actually transaction volumes have gone down 40% each year over 40% since 2013. If transaction volumes go down and prices go down, it can only be because demand has gone down by more than supply has increased.
Far be it from me to question the supply and demand curve, economics 101, beginning of your textbook, first day in the classroom.
Indeed.
But presumably there's a bit of elasticity to that where houses are different than shoes. If prices fall, I might buy three pairs of shoes. I'm probably only going to buy one house.
Yes. So, I mean, of course, I'd accept that. But it's still a good. And in fact, if you look at the economic research on what correlates most to real estate prices is actually household income. And that's just not it's not here in the UAE. That's across the world. There's a 0.8 correlation in the UAE, is 0.7 in the UK. So that is the factor that determines it most. Now, the question therefore becomes, if we accept that, well, can we find an explanation for why demand has been weak so we can kind of pad out this story? And that's what we've really done by looking at domestic economies, what we call the non-oil GDP in the UAE and the Gulf.
So when we're sitting here on the Business Breakfast talking about the amount of units that are set to come on in 2020 and beyond, and talking about the fact that therefore there is, you know, still price falls to happen in the market, you're listening to us, you're shaking your head and you're thinking that's not the full story.
Exactly. What I really, this is precisely the point of our research. What we've seen, it really comes back to oil, right? Now, obviously, what the government's, back in 2013, the average oil price was $105 per barrel. And in that year, governments in the Gulf, about 90% of their revenues came from oil and gas. Okay. And of course, they all ran very, very strong and healthy fiscal surpluses. Now, of course, if 90% of your revenues come from oil and gas prices fall significantly, then it's not surprising that these surpluses turn to deficits. And you know, in response to that, all the countries in the Gulf, they have these strong, very sustainable pegs, currency pegs. You can't just turn on the printing press. The responsible thing to do is to put in fiscal control. And that's exactly what the governments have done over the last few years, and it's essential.
And by fiscal control, are we talking VAT? Are we talking spending caps?
Both. So what it actually means a cut back on certain subsidies in the region. That's part of the spending controls. And, of course, fees and charges and taxes have increased as well. So spending cuts and revenue increases. Yes, exactly
right.
That.
So talk us through how that translates to me not buying myself a two-bedroom flat in the Greens.
Well, the easiest way, and we use this sort of technical term, transition mechanism, the easiest, if you think about it, if governments spend less and they're an important part of the economy, then that has an impact on government employment and it has an impact on private sector employment, less money circulating around the economy. And obviously, we all know people who've left the country. There's been an effect on the expat population as people have lost their jobs and gone home. And that is a very, very direct mechanism connecting non-oil GDP growth and demand for real estate, but also household incomes have not gone up. And that people feel less confident.
Let me throw this at you. You say that the reduction in prices hasn't led to an increase in demand, but I'm looking at one headline from not that long ago that says Dubai sees a record number of real estate deals in 2019. Over 44,500 real estate transactions were completed in Dubai. That's November to November, but good enough. Of course, the value is lower. They're million dirham apartments, not 10 million dirham villas on the palm. But nevertheless, does that not suggest that the market is responding to these lower prices?
Okay, so the last few years since 2013, other than a short spike in 2017, transaction volumes each per year went down every year. Now, it just so happens that from about September onwards in Dubai, we started to see a spike in transaction volumes. And it is absolutely the case that in November, there was a record number of transaction volumes comparing to every November on record. So that might suggest that sentiment has turned. But that's now. So that may be one indicator that prices are stabilising and things are getting better. But up until the last quarter of last year, it wasn't that story.
So where does that leave us for 2020 then? If what we should be looking at isn't the number of units coming online, but forecasts for oil prices and government budgets across the Gulf, what do you think is going to happen to property prices?
Well, so the good news is that this period of fiscal control is coming to an end. Now, we're not going to see the taps turned on again, precisely because governments are doing the responsible thing and factoring in current oil prices, if not lower oil price, into their budgeting. So the level of control is diminishing, which means that we're not seeing further cuts, okay? In that context, we would hope to see private sector growth come in. We've seen a lot of supply side reform, but growth is going to be trending towards the 2%. The non-oil GDP growth is trending towards 2%, certainly in the UAE and across, say, somewhere like Saudi. And in that context, with less supply addition, obviously supply addition is demand supply, with that coming down over the next 12 months, we're expecting to see stabilisation in the market. But we don't see an environment where oil prices go to $100, spending picks up again, and we see another strong upturn. I don't really think that's particularly... We don't want to see continued volatility in these really sharp cycles. I don't think that helps long term.
Our top story this morning is the increase in government salaries. We're between 9 and 16% here in Dubai. We've also had in recent weeks stories about the record budget in Dubai and a three-year budget in Dubai. We've got the Al Ghudair programme in Abu Dhabi, $50 billion being spent there just last week. Record budget for Sharjah. Again, 1 or 2% higher than last year, but nevertheless, it does suggest that there is some fiscal stimulus coming. How excited or not can we get about these things?
In the context of the UAE, Abu Dhabi, its budget really makes up 75% plus of general government spending in the UAE. So the key emirate to look at here is Abu Dhabi. And yes, they are, as I said, they've introduced a lot of supply side programs. That's part of the Tomorrow 21 program, and some spending commitments as well. And I think the bigger picture is what I said, is that, but you know, we're flattening out here. But none of this represents turning on the taps. Dubai, of course, is in a different situation. It doesn't rely on oil. So there's other things that they can do. And they're obviously intent on introducing some stimulus. But in the bigger UAE context, it's Abu Dhabi's budget that matters greatly.
And Dr. Christopher Payne, Chief Economist of Peninsula Real Estate, thank you very much for joining us in the Business Breakfast this morning.
Thank you for having me in.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast. The Business Breakfast's Pick of the Papers.
Starting with the Swiss newspapers. The sound of yodeling is echoing around the mountains in the Swiss ski resort of Davos. And here to look through the Swiss newspapers and the Swiss stories on the ARN News Centre app is the news editor, Natasha Thomas. Morning, Natasha.
Good morning, Richard.
We're going to get to Davos in a second. We're going to hear from a number of UAE business leaders who are there. But first of all, a little bit closer to home. You've been looking at someone who, a business person, who's donated $500,000. What can you tell us about this?
That's right. So this business person is from Dubai. His name is Ahmed Sultan bin Salim. And Dubai police have revealed that this Emirati businessman helped raise money for 10 inmates and paid 506,053 dirhams, and this money was given to the Al Awir Central Jail. And so now these Dubai inmates who were jailed because of the fact that they couldn't repay their loans, etc., they're now going to be released. And Dubai police have obviously commended his actions. They are hoping that other individuals and organizations will be inspired to contribute to the UAE's humanitarian efforts.
That's good to know. Now, let's talk about the coronavirus. The UAE is looking at this one very, very closely. What's the latest?
Yes, they're looking at it very, very closely because there has been an outbreak in China that has affected more than 200 people. So the Ministry of Health and Prevention has confirmed that there have been no cases so far reported in the UAE. They say they have an effective monitoring mechanism in place, and this way they're able to ensure that nobody is able to enter the country, or they're able to detect people who may have the symptoms or the disease when they're coming in. So they also said they are on standby and have been for a long time at all ports in of entry in the country to handle any cases.
Finally, talk to us about Sri Lanka and a hotel that has a new permanent guest.
Yes. So a hotel in Sri Lanka, it's called the Jetwing Yala Hotel. I've been looking where it is. It's in a place called Kirinda, Palatupana. Have you heard of this place?
Don't know that. I've been to Colombo. I've been to the south. I've been to the tea plantations. Don't remember that one.
No, me neither. So this particular place, there's a new permanent guest, and it's an elephant.
You can hear our full exclusive interview with the elephant a little bit later on.
Yeah, so a lot of guests could be actually woken up by that sound. So since 2013, the bull elephant, his name is Natakota, has wandered around the courtyard of the Jetwing Yala Hotel. Earlier, he used to just appear only for a few months at a time, but recently he's decided to call the place home. So he spends most of his days sleeping in the shade or taking walks along the hotel's footpaths. He's also been known to be quite mischievous. He steals fruit from cars or supplies from the kitchen. But apart from that, he's become quite popular with the other guests. And I've been checking the reviews of the hotel on, you know, websites like booking.com, and the elephant has been mentioned.
Does the elephant have a star rating?
It, I imagine his presence has helped the hotel get a good rating. So it's been rated 4.5 or something on Booking.
You have to be wary about getting too close for the Instagram moment. Because you'd want to get a selfie, wouldn't you, with the elephant? That's kind of the thing. But, you know, I'm sure he's 9 times out of 10 a placid, mild-mannered guy. Brandy, a little bit closer to home, kind of, the UAE delegation in Davos.
Yes, absolutely. We've got a number of UAE cabinet ministers and leaders in Davos who will be speaking on some extremely important things, actually, over the next 3 days. Let me just give you some of them, and this is only some. We have Sheikh Ahmed bin Said Al Maktoum, the president of Dubai Civil Aviation, who is going to be speaking on a special session about the Dubai Silk Road reinventing trade and logistics. While the Minister of Economy is going to be speaking about the future of work, we have the Minister of Climate Change and Environment in Davos. He's going to be speaking on a number of environmental panels, while the Minister of State for Higher Education is going to take part in an event that plans to tackle the small issue of reskilling and upskilling a billion people in the next decade. Speaking of climate, actually, and Davos, because we know that this year the theme is stakeholders for a cohesive and sustainable world, hence the focus on things such as upskilling, dealing with the fourth industrial revolution, which, by the way, is something that the UAE, for the first time ever, is going to be holding an affiliated session on. It's going to be sort of chairing its own party, if you like, but a thinky party in which leaders from 50 countries are going to come together and talk about the governance issues that have been thrown up by the fourth revolution. But the sustainable world also obviously pertains to how to save the planet. That's one of the 7 key themes. And much is made of the private jets that come in to Davos. The estimate is that there will be around 600 plane journeys that can be attributed to Davos, and that includes everything from world leaders who don't tend to fly commercial. They tend to fly with military planes and land at a military airbase. Those on private jets and those on normal flights as well. I didn't realise, but the World Economic Forum actually says that it offsets the carbon from all the flights. So it sits down, it does the sums, and it invests in emissions reducing projects in order to offset the carbon footprint. However, activists say this doesn't go far enough because it doesn't actually stop the carbon from entering the atmosphere. It just sort of pays, if you like, to be allowed to do so. The World Economic Forum this year will also be using things such as electric cars and renewable energy, and it will be monitoring food waste.
Does it say what the activists want these leaders to do? Get on conference calls?
I think not come is actually the short answer. The cars that are that will be driving the VIPs around Davos, which is notorious for A, being hard to reach, and B, once you're there, being hard to get around the place, 88% of them will be electric or hybrid.
Mm. See, I'm leaning on the side of these leaders getting together and meeting, because that's when decisive action is taken. Unless you're in the same room debating and discussing, I think it's difficult to take good decisions or policy decisions which affect the whole world.
Other things that the WEF will be doing is using local food suppliers to cut down on air miles, getting rid of any single-use plastics, and introducing alternative sources of protein to meat. Everyone's getting a tofu steak for dinner or a Beyond Burger. Probably more a Beyond Burger.
I mean, these are, you could argue, token gestures.
It doesn't stop the fact that you do have an awful lot of people on private jets, and private jets are always the things that get the fingers pointed at them rather than obviously economy, because you're taking, what, 8 people compared to 300 odd.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
We've been talking extradition this week. A bit obsessed with the fine art of doing a runner in the wake of Carlos Ghosn's flight to Lebanon. And right on cue, India has declared the UAE a reciprocating territory when it comes to enforcing civil decrees. In short, if someone legs it and they owe you money, you've got a better chance of getting it back. We are joined now in the studio by Keith Hutchinson, partner at the law firm Clyde & Co. Keith, good morning. It's lovely to see you.
Good morning. Happy to be back.
Talk us through this new agreement. What exactly does it mean?
So what we're talking about here is a bilateral treaty in legal terms between the UAE and India, which provides for civil court judgments to be reciprocally enforced between those states. So if you have a judgment in the civil courts in the UAE against somebody who has their assets in India, this agreement provides a legal mechanism now by which you can take your judgment from here over to India and hope to have a better chance of enforcing that in India against the assets of that individual or company to recover your money. And that's something that's been hugely, hugely problematic over the last 10 years in particular.
Now, I understand this is something that's both new and not new simultaneously.
Correct. From the press coverage I've seen, no one's actually mentioned that the agreement itself between the states was signed 20 years ago. Can you believe it? And this piece of the jigsaw signed in India last week was the final piece that was required to actually make it law in India. So it's been a huge source of frustration actually for the legal market and many companies who've been unable to date to use the mechanism.
So who is it going to target? What kind of scale of debtedness or financial wrongdoing are we talking?
The problem itself is a hugely significant one for the UAE over the last 10 years. And you've mentioned that India being the second largest trading partner of the UAE, there are a vast number of Indian-sponsored businesses in the UAE and Indian-backed businesses. And we've seen a huge number of defaults on loans. The SME lending market of the UAE banks was hit extremely hard, and lots of impairments on their balance sheets because of defaulting Indian borrowers or loans to Indian companies guaranteed by Indian individuals who, when things in the economy didn't go so well, people would abscond and skip the country to avoid the civil justice process. So there are a very large number of banks holding sort of claims against Indian entities or individuals who would like, I'm sure, now to take advantage of this new procedure. So it's potentially relevant to many, many corporates as well.
Is it just banks and corporates that can go after people, or is it individuals as well?
It would be, it's not limited to who can claim. If you have a claim which results in a judgment in the UAE courts against somebody who has assets in India, they don't have to be an Indian national. It can be someone who has money in India, and that is where you wish to take your judgment to enforce. It's open to anyone who has the right facts to suit needing to go to India to enforce.
And would you physically need to go over for court cases and the rest?
No, you wouldn't. You would instruct Indian lawyers to be able to pursue it for you. I mean, it's probably worth mentioning that there's a difference here between criminal and civil matters as well. This is very much focused on civil matters. So civil, commercial disputes, contracts, and also it does relate to personal matters as well. So there's likely to be effect in divorce case where you're talking monetary relief, those kinds of things that you need to pursue and enforce against someone. So I think it will be a significant deterrent to people who in the past may have felt they were untouchable by leaving the country and going to India. But only time will tell. The proof's in the pudding, as they say. Will it work in practice? We shall see.
But it doesn't physically bring them back here?
No, I mean, there you're probably talking more about extradition in the case of a criminal offence. There are extradition provisions in separate agreements, but this is all about getting money back in civil disputes where you have a judgment already in your favour saying that person A owes you money and you're unable to collect it here because they have their assets or their wealth in India.
Well, we're talking about India, but obviously that isn't going to be the only place that people disappear to, depending on where they come from. Does the UAE have agreements with other countries, with other blocks like this?
Indeed, it has a handful, most notably bilaterally. So one country to another, they have an agreement with China and another with France, which have been in place for a number of years, and then India for 20 years, but now only in force. There are also regional agreements, multilaterals, between the GCC. There's one between the GCC states, which provides for intra-regional enforcement, which has always been in place for sort of many years. And then there's a wider one that incorporates some of the African nations called the Riyadh Convention. So yes, there's always been the regional portability of judgments, but this is now very significant because of the amount of India-UAE trade and the problem it has been.
How often are those other agreements used? How often are these things enforced?
The intra-Gulf treaty, infrequently, but you do see it from time to time. The other treaties, very rarely. People should be aware of them in the legal community, but I think people take them with a slight degree of trepidation because enforcing judgments internationally is inherently problematic. It's possible and it takes time, but people, I think, maybe try and focus locally rather than looking internationally.
Is it expensive?
Yes, I'd say people need to be prepared to spend money to go through the legal process in this country and then follow another process in the foreign country as well, be it India or China or wherever. So they're not easy procedures and they need lawyers.
And so what do you expect to see now as a result of this agreement finally getting its final page stapled on? What could happen next?
Well, one of the provisions of the agreement says that it applies to claims, cases, judgments that arose prior to its coming into force and after. So I think there will be a very large number of people.
So it's retroactive?
Yes, as we sit here now, holding judgments against Indian nationals or persons who have their assets in India, who either may now look to actively pursue and enforce those, or people who are holding back on claims. Often you'll find people don't pursue claims because they realise that their recovery prospects are slim. This will now provide a much better option for them, I think, to reconsider whether they should spend that money to pursue.
So good work for lawyers.
Yes, thankfully.
Keith Hutchinson, partner at the law firm Clyde & Co. Thank you so much for joining us on The Business Breakfast.
Thank you.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.